Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
The month of March has been historic for Native Americans. Last week, Deb Haaland of the Laguna Pueblo became the first indigenous cabinet secretary in U.S. history. She now runs the Department of the Interior. More than a century earlier, the man who then held that same position, Alexander Stewart, stated in 1851 that Native people were, quote, encompassed by an unbroken chain of civilization. Stewart also
described his job as to, quote, civilize or exterminate us, and us being Native people. And when you think about the weight of that history and what this department has done to Native people, to Native lands, you know, I get goosebumps just thinking about what this means.
That's journalist Jonathan Brave Noisecat of the Canem Lake Indian Band. Then there's the passage of the Biden administration's American Rescue Plan. Tucked into the $1.9 trillion package is $31 billion in spending specifically for Native communities, the single largest infusion of cash for Native American schools, health services, for infrastructure, and more. Tracy Morris, a member of the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma and executive director of the American Indian Policy Institute, calls the plan a down payment on a long overdue debt.
Our programs have never been funded to the level that they needed to be, so this is a really good start. It's a really good start. It's going to be historic, just like the bill itself is historic. It's historic for Indian country as well.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today on Point, the American Rescue Plan and Native communities. Could this be a transformational moment for Indigenous people? Well, we'll start today with Dante Desiderio, executive director of the nonprofit NAFOA, formerly known as the Native American Finance Officers Association. He joins us from Washington. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Meghna.
And also with us is Stephen Rowe Lewis, governor of the Gila River Indian Community, which is located next to Phoenix, Arizona. Governor Lewis, welcome to you.
Good, skugtash, good day, Meghna. It's an honor to be here.
It's great to have you both. So, Governor Lewis, if I can just start with you first, what difference, give us the big picture here. What difference will this $31 billion in resources make for Native communities like yours?
Well, this funding is an historic level of funding for tribal governments, not just because of the amount of funding, but because of the equitable treatment of tribal governments and the acknowledge, really, as a tribal leader, the acknowledgement of tribal sovereignty and self-determination that have played a tremendous amount of critical support in our response to this pandemic. You know, in the early days of the pandemic, what was missing for tribal governments was our federal partner. Our relationship is with the federal government as sovereign tribal nations. It's a government-to-government relationship, and until this year, the pandemic response was delegated to the states. So there were a lot of gaps and inconsistencies of how tribes were treated. And we realized early on that we needed to be innovative and entrepreneurial to make sure our community did not become a hotspot, you know, despite the state of Arizona becoming one of the world's top hotspots during the pandemic, two separate times during this public health emergency. So this funding is timely because the community, as you know, we utilize all of our funding from the CARES Act, and this American Rescue Plan Act funding will not only see the community and other tribes through the pandemic, but will help us to put the tribal infrastructure in place should we be faced with a similar situation in the future, but also address the disparities that have been persistent for decades and longer.
Right. And so that's the thing. It's actually much more than specifically COVID-specific, if I can repeat myself there, spending. Dante Desiderio, let me hear from you. I understand that you actually advocated on behalf of tribal governments for the inclusion of this $31 billion in funding. Tell us what you think, what a difference it will make.
Well, I think one of the things that can't be stressed enough, you heard from Dr. Morris and Governor Lewis on the idea of the past plays into this in a significant amount. The chronic underfunding by the federal government has been going on for generations, and that chronic underfunding had consequences during this pandemic. So Indian country had higher infection rates and higher death rates than any other population in the nation, especially early on in the pandemic. So the amount of funding allocated to tribal governments in the American Relief Plan, it won't solve everything, but it goes a long way in being able to address some of these social and economic disparities that have been laid bare during this crisis. And I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, one is the inadequate funding for housing. Mm-hmm. We have the highest occupancy rates in housing in the country. And when a pandemic hits and you have multi-generational housing and you have a community or Indian communities in general that have higher social interactions, it can be devastating during a pandemic. And the other part, and I know we'll get to this a little bit later, is the Indian Health Service has been chronically underfunded. So any surge at all means that we're at capacity pretty quickly. So we had to really scramble and get really creative. So some of the funds that have already been out and trying to give us some support for the impacts were good. What I think for this conversation, more specifically the American Relief Plan, what it does is help us not just deal with the impacts like we have been in trying to organize these crisis centers to take care of our people and protect our people, but it's going to help us recover and hopefully come out of this crazy time more prepared, more structured. And, you know, the hope would be that we also have more diverse economies. And just on that last point, we rely on economic development to fund our government programs and services because of this chronic underfunding by the federal government. So it goes beyond just an economic downturn. It's an economic and a government downturn. It's a funding crisis.
Right.
And our industries are a huge part of our economy in general in Indian country is in the hospitality space. Mm-hmm. So tourism, hotels, gaming, and all of that
heavy
completely
hit by the
shut
pandemic.
Down. Yeah. Completely shut down. So you had in Indian country, it was multiple crises that were hitting the economic and the healthcare. So going forward in the American Relief Plan, there's this idea that one is going to be a longer time period, which is very hopeful. There's a bit of infrastructure in there. So the idea is that we're going to build out, be able to be in a position to protect our people, have more diverse economies, and really look forward.
Yeah. So I want to actually, we're going to spend some time really diving into detail on some of what this $31 billion is marked for Native communities, because it's really interesting and you know, I want us to collectively learn what difference this could make in many aspects of life. But before we do that, you mentioned sort of this historic underfunding. Can you talk a little bit about like previous spending packages that were passed in what, the 70s and 80s? I mean, how does this compare?
Well, I don't think we have to look that far back because there hasn't really been too many historic spending packages for Indian country. It's a reason that tribes during the Self-Determination Act during the 1970s under President Nixon, of all people, went towards self-determination for tribes. The federal government was realizing they weren't going to meet these obligations and tribes were going to try to grow their economies to be able to take care of this. So spending, the only reference we can go to is during the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, mm-hmm. you know, just over a decade ago. And during that time, President Obama had provided significant resources, which we thought were, you know, it was about $2.7 billion, maybe $3 billion in resources, which effectively doubled the budget of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and got some help out in a programmatic way. I think what's different about this package and its its impact will be significantly better because this is discretionary money. Mm-hmm. This is the federal government recognizing that tribes have the ability to know what's best for their own communities and really take care. Every tribe is different. Every tribe has different historic consequences that they're working through. Every tribe has a different approach to developing their communities and different cultures. So this discretionary money is historic. The only thing we can turn to as significant funding before this was the Recovery Act, and that went out through programs.
Right. And so, Governor Lewis, let me turn back to you. I'm seeing here that the tribes have until, what, the end of 2024 to decide how they'll use that fund, that discretionary aspect of it, as Dante was talking about. Do you yet know how the funds will be allocated among the tribes, or how that's going to work? Governor Lewis, you with us? Okay, we're going to try to get him back. Dante, I'll turn to you for that then.
Yeah, we have a pretty good idea. I think during the CARES Act, a lot of this was, the federal government trying to figure this out, sometimes in a very clunky way. So we have experiences, and we can learn from last year. It seems like so long ago. Really, what we're looking at, the likely scenario would be to take these two principles of the American Relief Plan, which is to get money out to tribes to take care of their people and for tribes to be able to build their economy. So taking care of your people, it means that it's likely going to be a population, a per capita, or taking in consideration the tribal population. And the second measure to that will likely be their economic impact of the tribe. Some tribes have a smaller population, but a very large economic impact, with some being some of the largest employers in their states and things like that. So that impact we're going to try to deal with as well. So those two look like how the federal government will approach this, and then the tribes will get a proportionate share of that funding and be able to take care of both of those main objectives for Indian country.
Now, $20 billion is allocated specifically to combat COVID. That leaves what, $11 billion, almost $12 billion, or $11 billion, let's say $11.2 billion, for a myriad of other aspects of improving tribal life. How much of a difference will that make?
That's going to make a significant difference. So we see a lot of the funds being dedicated to things like getting our food and nutrition programs up to where they need to be, transportation. We also see the idea of getting education funded. And something I hope we touch on is the cultural impact.
Yes, we most certainly will. So hang on here for just a minute. We are diving deep into the historic $31 billion in funding that's going to Native communities as a result of the American Rescue Plan. We're understanding what it would be used for and what a difference it will make to these communities. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about the $31 billion in funding that's inside the American Rescue Plan. This $31 billion specifically going to tribal nations in the United States, and the difference the infusions of funds could make, and the bigger picture for indigenous people in the country right now. I'm joined today by Stephen Rowe Lewis. He is governor of the Gila River Indian Community, located next to Phoenix, Arizona. Dante Desiderio joins us as well, executive director of the nonprofit NAFOA, formerly known as the Native American Finance Officers Association. And I just want to read a little bit of a list here of where some of these funds are set to go to. $19 million for tribal community efforts to combat domestic violence, $20 million to mitigate the impact of COVID on native languages through language preservations and maintenance grants, $1.2 billion for housing and urban development tribal programs, over $1 billion for native education programs, $900 million for Bureau of Indian Affairs programs such as tribal government services and potable water delivery, $6 billion for the Indian Health Service for vaccinations, mental and behavioral health, and more, and $20 billion for tribal governments to combat COVID-19. So let's listen to a moment to Carla Fredericks, a member of the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation. She's also executive director of the Christensen Fund, a foundation that promotes indigenous rights around the world.
When I looked at all of this over the course of this week, I was really thinking about how, for the first time in a really targeted way, the tribes are really being treated much like state and local governments. And so, you know, the bulk of this money is COVID relief money, and how the tribes will use that, I'm sure, will be to their own sovereign and self-determined ends, which will, I think, necessarily have a really strong investment theme. But just like state and local governments, the tribes are really hurting. And this bill really reflects a response to that.
Tracy Morris is executive director of the American Indian Policy Institute and a member of the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma. And here she talks about why the cumulative effect of the pandemic hit Indian country especially hard.
That was another thing that folks never understood with COVID, is that we had to shut down our casinos. Well, oh, poor you. So did Vegas. It's not the same. Tribes are both governments and they are business owners. That doesn't exist anywhere in this country. So because we live on land that is managed by the Department of Interior's Bureau of Indian Affairs, we can't tax that land. So there's no tax base for the government to run. So our enterprises like gaming that got shut down stopped all of our funding of our governmental works.
That's Tracy Morris, executive director of the American Indian Policy Institute. Governor Lewis, I was wondering if you wanted to respond to that about sort of the not just the health impacts, but the broader economic impacts that tribal nations have suffered due to COVID. You had been talking about that a little bit earlier, but did you want to expand on that?
Yes. Well, Professor Morris was exactly right on. You know, tribes are very unique, sophisticated governmental organizations, but because of no tax base, all the economic profits do come back directly to tribal governments to provide direct services, those governmental services. The economic business enterprises provide the funding for tribal governments to run and to get those critical services out there to the community, infrastructure needs. We can't rely on the state or the federal government. We have to rely on ourselves. That's why this pandemic has highlighted where the lack of federal funding and support, those gaps have been, you know, both in the past and currently. That's why Indian country has been disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. So you could say that with this funding, we're going to be able to start closing gaps created by decades of underfunding of critical programs, but addressing the most urgent needs of today, and doing so, of course, as Dante was saying, with an eye towards the future, Meghna.
So can I just jump in here? Because I think having a concrete understanding of how this money can directly close those gaps is really important, because we've got listeners who say, I want to know how this will help things like the housing crisis and food desert situations on native lands. I'm really taken by the money marked for creation of potable water delivery in different tribal nations that need it. I mean, we know that that's been an urgent need in places. Professor Morris told us about she's particularly excited about the money that's going specifically to education, because she talked about how, due to the pandemic, when everyone had to go remote, there were many Native kids who didn't have access to broadband or laptops. And so getting broadband into these communities, she said that's going to be life changing. So are those some of the things that are like really concrete changes that could come fairly quickly, Governor Lewis? Are there others that you're particularly that you think are particularly notable?
Well, definitely. You know, as a tribal leader, you know, on the ground in Indian country, you know, with my community, you know, we see with this new resource, this historic level of resources, we are looking at as respecting and acknowledging tribal sovereignty and self-determination. We know better what our needs are now, what our needs have been in the past, what our needs are going to be in the future. We're looking at mobile vaccination units, for example. You know, we want to make sure that vaccines get to our community members to achieve what we call, we hear about herd immunity, but what we call community immunity. Because as Dante was saying, with housing, you know, we live in multi-generational families. It's a respect and it's a concern for everyone in the household, both the grandparents and great grandparents, all the way down to the young children. So we tailored our vaccination programs likewise, with a respect for our custom and traditions. So we know exactly what our people need at this time. The state, the federal government doesn't, but hopefully with the current Biden-Harris administration and now, you know, with some historic picks such as Deb Haaland as the new Secretary of the Interior, they will respect with Deb Haaland now, you know, have just such an intrinsic knowledge of tribal sovereignty that this funding will allow us the flexibility to start to use these resources as we need to address these critical issues, such as housing as well.
Right.
We have had to really be entrepreneurial and innovative. That's a strength of us as Native people surviving.
Yeah. So if I just turn back to Dante here for a quick second. I'm wondering if you have an example or two of some, if I could use this term, some of the other shovel-ready projects that Native communities have sort of had in the works but couldn't actually start because of this lack of funding. Because you can see I'm trying to get a deep understanding of really the immediate day-to-day impact that this long overdue infusion is going to have.
Right. So I think one of the things worth noting, there's tribes in all kinds of different situations. So when we're still talking about, this is 2021, we're still talking about passing legislation to allow us to get potable water to our communities.
Right.
The disparities are pretty amazing. So when you're looking at the funding coming in and the use of this in a discretionary way, what it does is allow tribes to hope, to really look at different ways of implementing the plans that they've done over and over again, and look at these different projects. There is in the American Rescue Plan this idea that tribes do need to, because of the recognized disparities, use some of this funding for wastewater treatment and plants, and also water projects. Mm. And also the idea of broadband. You brought up the point, and Governor Lewis, that our kids are being left behind because of the lack of internet access. And we can't really afford to have that happen. So it is well known in Indian country on a lot of different communities that when you get to on the reservation, the access to basic wireless service and internet access is abysmal. So how do you jump over that hurdle and trying to create these spaces where your kids can still go to school and learn in a remote environment? So that's really fortunate that we have broadband in there in a number of different ways to be able to support tribal communities to not just catch up, but look at using new technologies to really look forward. And, some of the other things that tribes are doing, it's creative use of and this recognition of the food sovereignty, or the idea that we need to create and go back to, in some cases, a cultural way of looking at providing for your community. So some tribes are looking at developing out, their buffalo herd and trying to use that. It both satisfies this cultural place in some tribal communities, and also looks at how you're feeding your community using your local resources. And there's been, you know, other purchases of cattle, and looking at, you know, forward looking is that, you know, you're doing your own processing mm-hmm. in your community so that you have that as an ongoing solution. So everything we're looking at now for the specific uses of the American Rescue Plan is also looking forward in some of those really specific cases. Broadband will change everything from access to healthcare to our kids being able to learn to how you're doing business. It's no longer an option. It's a necessity. And I think that's the biggest change you're going to see. Is it sounds boring in getting these basic infrastructure in there, but it can be, we can leap forward. It's not just a step forward. We can leap forward with access to this new technologies, to getting clean water out to, you know, places on the Navajo Reservation or the Alaska villages.
You know, Dante, if I may say, it never sounds boring to try to meet the needs of basic infrastructure for people in 2021. That's why I think these details are important. It is not boring. It's vitally important for survival, to thrive. And so and that's what I'm trying to understand, really, like, how are these funds going to be used to meet those needs? So I assure you, not boring. But I want to sort of refocus for a second on health here, because I know that's a big part of this picture. And again, the $20 billion out of the $31 billion for COVID-related funding and for Native health programs. But in order to do that, let's just listen to a moment of actually you, Governor Lewis, being interviewed by a reporter with your community's broadcast service at a vaccine drive at a local raceway.
Governor Lewis, if you can you share a little bit of what you saw today and what's making today so special?
Right. Thank you. And good morning, everyone out there. Hope everyone's staying safe. This is our third vaccination event, the drive-through. Now, you know, we're still here at Wild Horse Pass, the raceway. And so we have a very good setup. There's a long queue of cars waiting to get their second booster shot. And so, you know, we're just so happy that we're going to get fully vaccinated individuals at our casinos, at our enterprises, our community businesses as well.
That's Governor Stephen Roe Lewis of the Gila River Indian Community talking about a vaccination effort at Wild Horse Pass. So let me bring in another voice into the conversation now. Dr. Mary Owen joins us. She's president of the Association of American Indian Physicians and director of the Center of American Indian and Minority Health at the University of Minnesota, joining us from Duluth. Dr. Owen, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna.
So give me your first take specifically on Native health. How much will these new funds make a difference for health efforts in Native communities?
I think Dante said it really well. These funds really provide some hope for us. Tribal consultants have pointed out that to bring the Indian Health Service up to full funding would take $48 billion. Annually, we have increases of maybe 2 to 3% to the Indian Health Service budget, which is this year, I think, was at $6.9 billion. And those don't even keep up with medical inflation. So, you know, as has been pointed out, I believe, on this show, the U.S. government has a trust responsibility to provide health care to Native people because of all the lands that were taken from us. And it has never upheld that agreement. So, as also was mentioned earlier in the show by one of your reports, this is really a down payment to start catching up. Will it make a difference? Absolutely. Not just because of the money that's being put into the Indian Health Service, but as you were talking about, the money that's being put into housing and education, because those things affect our health. Specifics, you wanted specifics on how this is going to help us. We already have some of the highest rates of suicide in the country, and yet this bill will measure contains $420 million for mental and behavioral health services. So we'll be able to increase the numbers of counselors that we need, because in fact, our rates of suicide and depression and trauma from COVID have gotten worse, of course, from the pandemic. So we desperately need those monies. Another specific is, again, thought to be boring, but so critical, as is the potable water. You know, we don't just need that for COVID, and we need it for for people to be able to have these supplies, have these basics of life so that they're not stressed out and they can actually attend to other things like their healthcare, their housing, their education. Those are a couple examples.
You know, if I can just say, twice now I've heard the word boring. This is not boring. I mean, people have a right to potable water. And the fact that it's so hard to get in so many communities, especially Native communities in the United States, is unacceptable. So please do not feel the need to say it's boring to advocate for drinking water, okay?
Sometimes we say it so often that we think that people get bored of hearing
us. You get in the habit of it, I know. But you can't stop saying it because without water, there's no life. So,
that's right.
But Dr. Owen, we've just got a minute to go before the break. And you'll have to forgive me because I keep searching for these details because I think for people who are not members of these communities, of Native communities, who don't know the reality of day-to-day life, there is there's an opportunity to share these stories. So, you know, even when it comes to infrastructure, speaking of water, I'm reading here that some of the Indian Health Service buildings that physicians and medical workers are working in are like 70 years old in some of these communities. And the buildings themselves could use upgrade and maintenance, and that perhaps some of these funds could be used for that.
There are so many ways that this underfunding has hit us over the years, but primarily because we are so underfunded, we have to hit the basics first, and that's always patient care. So other things get ignored, like our buildings. They're on average 40 years old, and most medical buildings in the United States are 10 years old. We have physician vacancy rates of 46% in some areas. With vacancy rates like that, we get high turnover. We can get high turnover physicians, and we have physicians who go into our communities and then are gone after they go in to get their loans paid back, and then they're gone after 4 years.
Dr.
So
Owen,
constant turnaround.
We just have to take a quick break here, but we'll talk more about health and culture when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about global vaccine distribution. So far, 90% of COVID-19 vaccination doses have gone to rich and middle-income countries, and poorer countries are having trouble getting their hands on vaccines. So some are calling for pharmaceutical companies to share their intellectual property to let vaccine manufacture for COVID-19 vaccines happen elsewhere. There's a lot of pushback to that, too. So we want to know what your questions are about global vaccine distribution or even just patent protection when it comes to vaccines and public health. And for folks listening to us internationally, hello, we know you're there. Tell us your stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That is for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the $31 billion in funds tucked inside the American Rescue Plan. And these $31 billion are specifically for Native communities across the country. It's this huge infusion of cash, historic in many ways. And we're talking about the difference that it will make to Native people in this country. I'm joined today by Stephen Rowe Lewis, governor of the Gila River Indian Community, located next to Phoenix, Arizona. Dante Desiderio joins us. He's executive director of the nonprofit NAFOA. And Dr. Mary Owen is with us as well, president of the Association of American Indian Physicians and director of the Center of American Indian and Minority Health at the University of Minnesota. And we're going to talk about culture in just a moment. But Dr. Owen, I wanted to stick with health for another minute or two, if I could, because you were talking earlier about sort of the concentric circles of health challenges, physical, mental, that Native people struggle with, and the higher incidences of certain diseases, et cetera. These are intertwined and challenging to solve. So I'm wondering if you think that you know, it's a long term process to get to a healthier community. But how much will this initial infusion of funds help get you down that road?
Well, I can't quantify. Okay. None of us can quantify, of course. But I think going back to that issue of hope, one of the problems I think that we face in Native communities is that we're constantly by the underfunding and the invisibility of our community, we're treated as second-class citizens. So by bringing this issue of the chronic underfunding of our communities, by infusing money into our education systems, our health systems, it sends a different message. It says that we're recognized. And so that's so critical, first, that empowerment of our communities. But specifically, as was mentioned, one example is broadband. Not only does that impact our education, but it's our health services. We can't always reach our patients without telehealth. And not all of our patients are able to be able to come into the clinics. So it has multifactorial effects, all of these issues do. But, you know, if people are don't have adequate housing, it's hard for them to focus on their education. If they don't have adequate education, they don't get decent jobs. If they don't get decent jobs, then they don't get decent housing. It's all circular, and those are those social determinants of health that we talk mm-hmm. about all the time.
Mm-hmm. Dante Desiderio, let me turn back to you for a second here before we really focus on the cultural piece of this here. Because I'd like you to be sure that I'm understanding this correctly. So this the $31 billion, it hasn't yet been allocated amongst tribal communities. Is that right?
Well, of the $31 billion, the $31 billion is the total price tag for the spending that's going to be allocated to Indian country. You know, the $20 billion of that has not been allocated. That's going to be allocated at the discretion of the Secretary of Department of Treasury. That's the discretionary money that tribes can be creative with mm-hmm. and really plug the holes where they need to be. The other is programmatic funding. So the increase in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the increase in Bureau of Indian Education, Indian Health Services, that's all in the programmatic side. So the total is the 31 plus billion. It encompasses both of those.
Got it. So is there any concern about competing needs between tribal communities for the $20 billion that you mentioned earlier?
There always is going to be, you know, I think this is a healthy debate to have. There's always going to be this idea of, you know, if you think about the larger tribes who have greater needs, they're going to want more on, say, a population number that's going to allow them to do certain things. The other tribes who really rely more on economic development are going to want, of course, more based on employees or that economic component of this. So, yes, there's competing needs, but I think what you have overall during this entire crisis is that tribes want to help other tribes. We're all in this together. We want to see money going out to all tribes. There is a healthy, you know, back and forth on what's the best funding, but no one wants to see anyone left out. We're all completely supportive, you know, of that $20 billion. $1 billion of this goes out right away in an equal amount to every tribe. So you have about 1.7 million that for every tribal community that's going to be getting that share. And that's more of a Native way to look at. We mm-hmm. we want to take care of all tribes, but of course there's going to be this healthy debate on trying to accommodate both of these factors.
Yeah. Well, so as I've said a couple of times, I should probably finally fulfill this promise. I want to talk about the cultural portions of or the cultural aspects that this money could significantly help with. For example, there are more than 150 indigenous languages spoken in the United States, But according to the Census Bureau, the majority of Native Americans routinely speak only one language, that being English. So native languages are definitely at risk of dying out. Now, to address that, the American Rescue Plan has set aside $20 million for the preservation of native languages. Now, in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, the language of the Mashpee Wampanoag was wiped out more than a century ago. But in the mid-1990s, an effort began to revive and reinvigorate the language, the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project.
Kuikwasanamu.
Kuikwasan.
Kuikwasan.
Sun Kunai Ukisakak?
Nikis Nunai.
Natasawis Melanie Roderick. The organization I work for is called the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project. I currently teach Wampanoag language mainly to high school students within the Mashpee Public School System.
Atawana some dog.
Anum.
Uh-huh, Nakis. Any little, even if it's one phrase that they remember at the end of the school year, that's one phrase I didn't know before.
Atawana some cat.
Pasuis?
Uh-huh, Nakis. Wani anakonsumon kino. I like teaching all ages. The real little kids, they're great too. It's very different. It's more just interacting with them and speaking the language and less actual instruction. You know, they just pick it up as we go along. So they learn the easiest and they learn the fastest.
There's a terrible irony in the story of the Wampanoag language. A Wampanoag translation of the Bible was used to convert the Mashpee Wampanoag away from their own religious beliefs. That same translation has helped them rebuild their language. That story begins in 1663 with a Puritan missionary named John Eliot.
John Eliot, with some native folks too, some early converts, translated the entire King James Bible into our language. So that's, yeah, it's a huge chunk of resources. You know, a lot of words in the Bible for sure. A lot of words not in the Bible as well, of course. The Bible is limited with what it doesn't offer us in terms of words for things like the native flora and fauna to hear. And that's one of the areas that we do a lot of work on still, but it's an area where we have to put in a lot of extra work. We have to do more digging. You know, those things are much harder to find.
Kunipiomu, Masipi Wampanoag Aniwaak, Kunipiomu, Nutaki.
And the way that we go about refiguring out those names for things, those words, is by looking at sister languages and hoping that they have a word for whatever it is we're looking for. Maybe it's milkweed, for instance. That's a word we've been looking at lately. But then, of course, there's lots of different milkweeds. You know, there's about 6 or 7 different species of milkweed in North America. So there was always some people that, you know, held on to some prayers, little bits of language, but no fluent speakers. Our best guess is that the last fluent speaking elder died right around the turn of the 20th century, 1900-ish. My Nana, who was born in 1904, you know, when she was a kid, it was certainly not something, it was, you know, you don't speak that kind of thing. When I started learning as a teenager, she was still alive then, and she, to my mother and myself, what are you going to do that, you know, speak that for? Because when she was growing up, you had to just try to blend as best you could, you know. It was speak English, you know, at least as good as our neighbors, and learn what they know and, you know, blend. We started doing this in the 90s, so it's been a couple decades, but it took generations. It took 200 years for our language to go, you know, from completely spoken by 100,000 people or so to nobody. So in my estimation, it's going to take, you know, it might take us a couple generations before we do reach that sort of, you know, babies just born being first language speakers of Wampanoag. Takes some time. But there's definitely, amongst the community, the interest is there.
Melanie Roderick of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. She's a teacher with the Wampanoag Language Restoration Project. Now, Governor Lewis, you're governor of the Gila River Indian Community in Arizona, and Melanie is a member of the Wampanoag tribe in Massachusetts, but of course the loss or elimination of language is a common has been a common experience amongst Native people, regardless of tribal affiliation. So I wonder if you wanted to talk about the money that's going to go to cultural preservation and why that's important.
It has been, and literally our name translates to people of the river. Our water was stolen from us. Our precious river was stolen from us over 150 years ago, and we fought back to protect and to regain our water rights. My father was one of the first Native American attorneys for my tribe and one of the first to pass the bar in Arizona and to represent our tribe and our water rights. And so we have that history of loss, but also that history of regaining our water, and of course our language and our culture are tied to that as well. And, you know, I like to say, and I think it's important that we talk about that this significant amount of money is a down payment on the future of for the responsibilities that have not been, and those promises that have not been, been lived up to. And I like to say to my people, because it is about hope and keeping hope during this incredibly dangerous time of loss and of a public health within the midst of a public health emergency. And I like to say that we stay Gila River strong.
Yeah.
And by doing that, you know, it is about maintaining those connections. And so using, you know, broadband, some of these resources for critical issues such as keeping our elders connected. We've purchased tablets for our elders to keep connected. You know, we have a long-term facility that we operate on our community. And so we've used those, you know, our residents in the long-term health facility, they weren't able to see their family because of the health concerns for over a year.
Yeah.
So we've had virtual visits for them and for, you know, it goes to our children as well. You know, we've had...
Well, Governor, if I can step in here, yeah. Sorry, just the your phone line's getting a little shaky, so forgive me for stepping in here, but Dante, let me turn back to you here for a second, because, you know, we've been talking a lot about things like physical infrastructure that the money can directly go to rebuild. But the cultural piece of it, it's almost as it's cultural infrastructure for a community, right? Spiritual infrastructure even to help, you know, strengthen and hold together and build a community. Is that how you see, you know, these other pieces of the funding?
Yeah, I see this in a much bigger picture, and the significance of this can't be lost here. So tribal leaders are different from every other elected leader in this country. They also have the responsibility of carrying on culture and carrying out ceremonial practices. So that makes these tribal leaders have the additional responsibility as well as the responsiveness to their community needs. The idea that we have the federal government stepping in to be able to say, we're going to fund the preservation of languages and other cultural components of your communities. It's recognizing the tribal way of governing, and it's also a complete federal policy shift. And only in the last couple of years has this happened. The federal government was in the business before of taking Native kids and sending them away to boarding schools to be taking away their languages. And they were also in the business of, you know, being able to tamp down on cultural activities. And the resurgence of the federal government recognizing, one, the role of the tribal leaders, but also recognizing how important culture is. It's not just for the tribal leaders. This is America's oldest languages. The tribal governments are the oldest governments, and we have the oldest cultures in this country. And I think it's so important as a national treasure to be able to go in this direction for the federal government. And when you look at what happened in the pandemic, the reason this is in there, or one of the reasons, is that the people who are most vulnerable were our older language speakers and the people who tell the stories in our community. When we lose an elder to COVID, we often lose a bit of that culture. You know, I know in my community, the elders tell stories during our culture camp and pass along what life was like, you know, from when they were growing up and everything. It's a valuable resource for passing that on. So the significance of this, I think, is really important to note.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we're out of time, but Dante Desiderio, executive director of the nonprofit NAFOA and a member of the SAPNI, historically based in North Carolina and Virginia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Stephen Roe Lewis, governor of the Gila River Indian Community in Arizona. Governor Lewis, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you so much. It's an honor.
And Dr. Mary Owen, president of the Association of American Indian Physicians and a member of the Tlingit Nation of the Pacific Northwest. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Owen.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.